You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and guest host Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Melody Fox today, and welcome to another edition to Answers for the Family. Alan Cardoza is out on assignment today, and each week we do bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing options to raising the quality of life for the whole family. We address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. With each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we have been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring to you Answers for the Family. Now, today's topic is about an effective program that addresses the most common yet most overlooked causes of weight gain: overeating driven by emotional and spiritual hunger and psychological imbalance. And the author with us today is Julie Simon, and we will discuss self-care skills, body balancing principles, and soul care practices that can put an end to overeating and dieting forever. Now, weight loss, better energy, improved health, and self-esteem will naturally follow with no need to count calories, weigh or measure food, go hungry, or perform exhausting workout routines. And that's always a good thing. So with us today, our guest is Julie Simon. She is the author of this wonderful book called The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual. She is a licensed psychotherapist and life coach, plus with 20 plus years of experience helping overeaters stop dieting, heal their relationship with themselves and their bodies, lose weight, and keep it off. And she also lives here locally in Los Angeles, California. So, Julie, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hi, Dr. Melody. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm so thrilled that you're here today, because I have to say this has been an incredible book, and I know I'll be referring a lot of clients to this book in the future and utilizing a lot of the skills that you have in here. And I was really pleased to see that you used a lot of cognitive behavioral, and I know you don't call it inner child work, but, you know, healing that emotional part of us or that feeling part of us as well that tends to want to overeat for comfort. And I wanted to know, I mean, I know a lot of people that when they get depressed or anxious or whatever, some people don't eat at all, but a lot of people I know, and myself included, tend to eat a lot. Is that how you know that you're an emotional eater, or, you know, what do you think?
Well, I think the first thing that you would want to ask yourself if you're trying to figure out if you're an emotional eater is if you eat when you're not hungry, if you eat when you're already full, if you tend to snack mindlessly, or if you tend to choose unhealthy comfort foods a large part of the time, mm-hmm. then we know that something is out of balance somewhere, and it might be in the emotional realm. It might mean you're eating emotionally. And so then I would want to see if the following apply to you. So if any of what I just said resonates, you know, you're doing any of those, then you might want to go a little further to see if it's emotional. And you might want to ask yourself, are you using food as a tranquilizer to dull emotions that are difficult to cope with?
So it's
like anxiety or sadness or anger or frustration. Go ahead.
Well, so I would imagine like emotional eating, it might be the addiction or the tool that you use, maybe much like alcoholics might use alcohol to soothe themselves or to forget about things or numb themselves. Some people use food.
Yes, I mean, you might be doing it, like you're saying, to soothe or comfort or numb, but you also might be doing it to silence self-defeating thoughts. You might be doing it as a way to procrastinate from taking charge of activities. Like an alcoholic, it might represent an attempt to fill up an inner emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so if any of that resonates, there's probably an emotional component to your eating.
Now, I was just curious, because we have families that are listening and a lot of parents, et cetera. And I was wondering if parents that do emotional eating or use food to soothe their child when they're upset, does that contribute towards using food as one of those tools to help deal with emotions?
Well, that does definitely contribute. You know, if a parent does not know how to soothe or comfort themselves, they may have trouble soothing and comforting their children. And so they may, you know, tend to offer their children food. We all have had, you know, grandparents or parents who baked cookies for us. And so something I always want to encourage parents to do is not develop that association with their children of giving them food when they're unhappy or when they're upset or when they're stressed out or when they're struggling with something, and rather sit with their child, help their child identify the emotions. This is a very important skill we're supposed to learn when we're young.
Mm-hmm.
Name and identify our emotions, and then help their children name and identify their needs. And if the parent can do that with a soothing, comforting, reassuring voice, that is a skill. Naming, identifying the emotion, identifying the need, and self-soothing, that's a skill that's going to serve your child throughout his or her life, whole life.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, so how does one become an emotional eater in other ways? If you're not learning to soothe when you're younger or your parents weren't able to soothe you, are there other ways to become an emotional eater?
Yes. I mean, a lot of people will come to my seminars and workshops and they'll say, you know, well, I had a great childhood and my parents were very nurturing and loving and and I still am using food. We can start using food at any point in our life. We might start using food because we've had significant losses or disappointments. I had a woman who wrote to me, and she never was a binge eater until she lost. She had two miscarriages in a row, and then almost had a birth and then lost that. And then she said she started binging. You know, she could not cope anymore. So anything that is going to tax our ability to cope with life, you know, traumas, losses, disappointments, divorces, you know, can be triggers that start us down a road of turning to food. And let's face it, food is incredibly convenient and a very quick fix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's everywhere. There's cupcake stores, cookie stores, the potato chip aisle. There's, you know, movies that perpetuate if you're feeling sad or you just broke up, you eat a, you know, not a pint of ice cream, a whole gallon of ice cream. It's like,
right. And if you have a sensitive kind of body and brain chemistry where you get, you know, just like an alcoholic, you can take one person and give them two glasses of alcohol and they'll just end up feeling sleepy. And you take another person and they'll have two glasses of alcohol and their brain will say, yes, like this is incredible, get me more, right? So it's the same with food. You'll have one person who could eat a cupcake and not have another one for 10 years, and the next person has one bite of a cupcake, and it starts something going. So we also have to look at, you know, the physiological imbalances mm-hmm. that can lead us to turn to food.
Yeah, and I know you get into that book a little bit later in your book about the chemistry of the brain and all that. I'd like to talk about that a little bit later. But let's go back to emotional eaters and emotionally hungry, or emotional hunger. Is that the same thing, or is that different?
Well, emotional hunger represents an appetite, a craving, or a desire, you know, in the absence of true physiological hunger cues. So emotional hunger often feels just like physical hunger. But generally, it's an appetite, like I said, without the hunger cues, and it's an exaggerated desire for pleasure, soothing, fulfillment, distraction, excitement. That's what emotional hunger is. It's an exaggerated craving for those states.
So the emotional eater has the emotional hunger.
Yes, the emotional eater is the emotional eater's appetite is driven by these unmet needs. These unmet emotional needs.
And those needs generally correlate back to our childhood?
Well, most of the time, I'll tell you, from 20 plus years of working with emotional eaters, the majority of the time, what most emotional eaters have in common is their early childhood experiences were undernourishing.
Mm-hmm.
So that could mean that they had very well-intentioned, loving, kind caregivers who were still possibly unable to teach them how to identify emotions, identify needs. Now, they may have had very loving caregivers, but often many people I work with came from backgrounds where their caregivers were distracted, their caregivers were self-absorbed, their caregivers were abusive in certain cases. So if your background was undernourishing, if it was traumatic, if it was chaotic, you know, these are the kind of things that will lead you to start turning to food, turning to an external source to meet internal needs.
Yeah, and I know in your book you have some wonderful tables that explain that more in detail. So if people are interested, the book is The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual. And it's got a lot of tools that really break that down to help you identify, you know, what emotional needs or what nurturing were you lacking or might have been lacking in childhood and how it plays out today.
Yes, because at the core of emotional eating, really at the core of overeating in general, but let's stick with emotional eating right now, at the core of emotional eating is disconnection. So we have disconnected from our signals, from our most precious, key, core, informative signals, our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And when emotional eaters come to work with me, often I'll say, okay, well, before you binged the other night, what do you think you were feeling? And they'll say, I haven't a clue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll say, I'm really upset about this situation. I'll say, okay, so you're upset. Let's cover more feelings. What does the situation make you feel? I don't know, right? So they're disconnected from their emotions. And quite often, they're also disconnected from their needs. So when we identify what they are feeling, okay, I wanted to go through the drive-through, and I was feeling tired and lonely and hopeless and scared. What did you need? I don't know what I needed, a cheesy bacon burger. No, okay, that wasn't what you needed. All right, a noodle dish. No, you didn't need food at that moment. There was something else emotional that you were needing. Julie, I haven't a clue what I'm needing.
Yeah,
okay.
We hear a lot of that from people coming into therapy. It's like, I don't have a clue. I don't know why I do these things. Is that where that emotional disconnect is?
That's where the emotional disconnect is. And to most of these people, this is a new language, right? I mean, I don't care if they're 45 or 75 years old. This is a new language to begin to identify what they're feeling. And I like to say to them, you know, it's so exciting because you have this phenomenal mind, body, and spirit that give you a multitude of signals every single day to help you stay in balance. And we start with the most basic signals like hunger, cravings, fullness, emotions, needs, thoughts, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to learn to tune in. Most of us know we know how our complex technological devices work more than we know how our emotional system works.
Right.
That's dangerous.
So how do we fix that?
So we relearn, or we learn for the first time, how to go in, and there's a technique I have in the book. It's a self-care skill I call self-connection. This is the critical skill for ending the disconnection. So we go in, and when we want to turn to food, so when you want to stop at the bakery, when you want to go through the drive-through, when you want to open that refrigerator another time, just pull away for a few minutes. I prefer if you take out a piece of paper because you'll be more focused if you write this down.
Mm-hmm.
And you just ask yourself, what am I feeling? And in the book, I give a whole chart on emotions, so you can, if you're not familiar with the language of emotions, you can look at the chart.
Mm-hmm.
We do that in my 12-week program. People pull out their chart. You know, they say, I don't know what emotion I'm feeling. And they look at it and they go, oh, I think it's hurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Identify, what am I feeling? I want to go back to the refrigerator again. Maybe you identify that you're feeling a little lonely, that you're feeling a little unfulfilled. Life is feeling a little boring to you now. You're unstimulated. Okay, what do I need? I have another chart in the book for needs.
Mm-hmm.
You can sit down and figure out, what am I needing right now in my life? You must be able to get clear on these things before you can address them, right?
Absolutely.
Third step is, and this is a very important step, and this is what I talked about earlier, if your caregivers were able to help you identify your emotions and identify your needs and then talk to you in a nourishing voice, then you would develop a nourishing voice inside of yourself. So the third step is to access that wise inner nurturer inside and have her talk to you. Okay, I understand that you're feeling really lonely tonight. You know, we've just left work, and work isn't feeling very stimulating right now. And I understand that you're feeling drained and, you know, unfulfilled. And I'm here with you. And together, we can resolve these needs. The cheesy bacon burger isn't going to do that. That noodle dish isn't going to resolve any of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
How about if we go home and we make something a little bit healthier, and then let's just sit down and figure out what we might be able to do, you know, to start to address these issues.
So you
have something like that inside yourself.
So what you're doing is, like you had mentioned earlier, relearning. It's learning to nurture yourself, learning to take care of that part of you. And I think you call it the feeling self. I know when
yes.
I work with people, I call it the inner child, or that feeling part is that child that didn't get his or her needs met. So
the inner child or the feeling self, whatever you want to call it. Yes.
So learning to nurture that. Now, you know, what if there's resistance and that part of you doesn't believe that you're going to be able to help them soothe?
Well, it's a great question, and there's always resistance. And this is a step where people always resist the work. And in my 12-week program, you know, we'll go around and we'll practice doing this, and you'll be amazed at how few people have a nourishing voice inside. The voice they talk to their feeling self with is often critical.
Mm-hmm.
It's often harsh. It's
yeah.
often giving a lecture. It's often not very understanding and validating. It's more like, well, you got yourself into this mess. You know, you got to get yourself out of it.
Like the messages you might hear from your parents or a coach or a teacher or what have you growing up.
Right. A tough love, not very nourishing, not very soft. And, of course, that's why they're coming to see me, because they really didn't develop that voice. So there is resistance to doing that. And what I say to people is, if you wanted to learn to ride a bike, if you wanted to learn to play the piano, if you want to learn a foreign language, you are not going to be skilled at it overnight, period.
Mm-hmm.
You have to practice. So I say to them, I know it takes work to practice this, and your inner nourishing voice is not going to feel soothing immediately. You may have to get some exposure to that with a therapist or a coach or someone who's nurturing in your life. But what I say is, do the exercise anyway. So let's say you've gone to the drive-thru and you're about to order that bacon burger, and you say, okay, let me pull in the parking lot and just do this exercise that Julie said. Just do it for Julie. Do the exercise. At the end of it, you might say, okay, I don't feel very much better. I kind of am a little more clear on what I'm feeling, what I need, but I don't feel soothed by my own voice. Okay, then go get the food. Continue to allow yourself to turn to the food until the skills are developed, okay? Because emotional eating is not going to resolve overnight. You know, often you're not going to feel soothed by your own voice in session one or session five, but if you stick with it, I liken it sometimes, if anyone's ever meditated, when you start meditating, it's the most uncomfortable thing on the planet. I mean, you just can't quiet your brain, you're antsy, you're restless. If you stick with it over time, you start to access this very delicious place inside.
Mm-hmm.
But you never will know that if you don't push through some of the discomfort to get there.
Yeah, and that sometimes it can be very difficult, because and cause more anxiety for some people. Or I know a lot of people that come into the practice and they know this. They know they need to be doing this and identifying this and thinking about it. But that feeling part, it just wants it so much. Yeah,
it's true. That's why I think working with professionals like yourself, like me, is so helpful when you're going through this, because someone else initially models the voice of the inner nurturer. So I work with my clients and I'll model that voice and I'll say, I can so understand feeling the way you're feeling. It just makes perfect sense. And, you know, life has felt very hard for you and it's not been easy. And often they'll start to cry.
Mm-hmm.
and they'll really start to feel some of the grief, some of the loss, some of the disappointment, some of the pain. And they will often tell me after they feel all that, I feel a lot better now, right? And I'll say to them, I'm going to teach you how to do what we just did for yourself. Mm-hmm. So that when you're turning to food and there's all this stuff that's been brewing and bubbling up inside of you that you don't access, I'm going to teach you how to access it, how to release it, and how to comfort yourself through it and get to the other side. And I have walked my talk. I mean, this is my own recovery. This is a path I went down. I know exactly what it feels like.
So you're once an emotional eater yourself.
Totally. I was totally an emotional eater. Every single thing I teach in the book and in my 12-week program is based on my own recovery and everything I've observed over 25 years working with people. And I sit there with them and I say, I remember, writing this stuff and it not feeling nourishing and going and eating anyway and saying to myself, but I was determined to stick with it because I said, I want recovery. I want to get to a day where I no longer have these food and body image issues. And I did that. And during the recovery, during the journey, I didn't know until I got there that it was really even possible. You know, for many points in time, it didn't even feel possible. So I thought, how will I ever stop turning to food? How will I ever, feel really good about myself? How will I ever have a normal relationship with food? And I'm walking and living and breathing proof that it's totally possible, and that's why I'm so passionate about it.
And I think that's what makes your book and how you write it and how concise it is different from any other thing, because you're not putting the focus on being a diet book or a weight loss program. Because, as I mentioned in the intro, it's like if you take care of the emotional part, if you're an emotional eater, then you're not going to be eating as much. So it goes to follow that you will lose some weight. You will eat better because you'll be nurturing yourself in a healthier way.
Right. The weight loss part is effortless. You know, the work, when people come to me, I often ask them to take the focus off of weight loss for a while. And most people, that's really hard for them to think of doing when they come to see me. I say, look, you've done all the diets. I have people who come to me who have done gastric bypass and lap band and hypnosis and every diet and shot and pill and you name it. And they've gained weight, they've lost weight, they've gained it back. And I say, look, you've already done all that and it didn't work. So give me some time, give us some time without the focus being on weight loss. Let's stop, let's just accept ourselves right now where you are. I know you don't want to be in this body at this weight. I know you want the weight off yesterday. Mm-hmm. But let's just accept where we're at, because that's part of the journey is self-acceptance. Let's accept where we're at and let's begin to build skills. And when we get these skills into place, I promise you, the weight will start to drop off. And you will say to me, you're not dieting. It's amazing. You're not watching every calorie, counting every calorie, weighing yourself, and you're losing weight. And people, and I have, lots of testimonials of that.
Yeah, and in your book, you suggest to the reader, reject the diet mentality, and that's what you're talking about.
Yes, the diet mentality is, what our culture has been promoting for, my God, 50-plus years. And it's very dangerous, and most of us in this culture have some diet mentality. We have deeply entrenched thoughts and habits, mm-hmm. That are related to controlling our food intake. For example, people are constantly thinking about what they're eating, they're counting and restricting calories. And I have people come in all the time, they'll say, I've been counting my calories now and I'm doing well. I'm eating 1,000 calories a day. And I always try to explain to them, that's not how your body works. Animals in the wild do not count calories. They don't weigh and measure food or their bodies. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be doing that. And in fact, when you do that, you start to disconnect from your signals, right? Because you're hungry and yet you already ate this amount of calories. So now you're not listening to your hunger.
Mm-hmm.
So the diet mentality is very dangerous. It takes us right back to disconnecting from our signals.
And in your book, you talk about paying attention to not only those body signals, but also the mind and the spirit signals. Can you give some examples of these?
Yes, well, the mind signals we talked about. So the mind signals are emotions, needs, thoughts. There was one more I was going to say, and I just lost my thought on that. But the mind signals are emotions, needs, and thoughts, okay? Uh-huh. If we talk about body signals, you know, there are all kinds of body signals. We've got hunger, we've got cravings, we've got fullness. Your body lets you know with restlessness in the morning that it's time to get out of bed. Your body lets you know with fatigue at night that it's time to go to sleep. So our bodies are incredibly wise, giving us signals. And our spirit gives us signals all the time. Inspiration, passion, purpose, meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Or apathy, boredom, low motivation, right? These are signs from our spirit as to whether we're taking good care of our soul. And we need to learn to pay attention to these signals. I find most people I work with, they don't want to pay attention because they don't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. And once we know and learn what to do with our signals, even if we can't address the needs immediately. So let's say someone says to me, well, I know what I need. I need a partner in my life. But I'm too old, I'm too fat, I'm too this, and I'm not going to have a partner very quickly, so it's hopeless, mm-hmm. right? So I say to them, well, okay, it's great that you can identify what you're feeling and what you're needing, but now we have to learn how to be with those needs, even when they can't be met right now, and learn how to hold hope and learn how to maintain some optimism, right?
Right.
So there are more skills to be learned.
And I want to talk about a couple of those skills when we get back. We have to take a quick break. But when we get back, we'll talk more to our guest today, Julie Simon, the author of The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual, licensed psychotherapist and life coach who's written this practical mind-body-spirit guide for putting an end to overeating and dieting. And Julie, stand by, and we'll be right back with you with more Answers to the Family in just a minute.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back for more Answers of the Family. I'm your host today, Dr. Melody Fox. Alan Cardoza is out on assignment, and our guest today is Julie Simon. She is the author of The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual, a practical mind-body-spirit guide for putting an end to overeating and dieting. And Julie, welcome back to more Answers of the Family.
Thank you.
Standing by for that minute. Now, we were talking earlier about the importance of developing that nurturing voice that could soothe, comfort, and reassure us instead of going to the food. And in the first part of your book, you talk about four habits that people with a healthy level of self-acceptance naturally engage in. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I know that's how you help people work through this.
Yeah, well, one of the skills in the book that I teach, which is such an important skill for emotional eaters and for anybody in general, is to learn how to practice unconditional self-love and self-acceptance. And, you know, we can all talk about that, but it's very challenging. How do we do that? You know, people come to me and they say, well, it's great for me to accept myself, but I don't accept my cellulite, or I don't accept, you know, my big arms. So we have to learn how to move towards self-acceptance and unconditional self-love. And there are steps that we can take, and this is what I've outlined in that chapter, is the four habits that people who have a healthy level of self-acceptance naturally engage in. Mm-hmm. So the first habit is to practice daily self-affirming commentary, okay? So what that looks like is you know, someone else might say it's stroking themselves, right? And I like when people do that. So I prefer that people say things like, I'm proud of myself that I returned that phone call because I didn't feel like doing it. I'm happy with myself that I exercised once this week. It's more than zero. So positive, self-affirming commentary all the time. I'm proud of myself that I washed the floor. You know, good for me that I cleaned up the dishes, right?
So it's important not to jump into that negative critical, well, all you did was wipe the floor when you needed to do the vacuuming too.
Right, exactly. Like, well, all I did was do that, and I have a long list to go, and I didn't get to it, right?
Right. So it's really
retraining. I say to people,
yourself,
if I have a long list and I didn't get to it, I always say self-affirming things to myself. I say, well, it was nice that I, you know, had those big, lofty goals to get to the list, but I guess I was very tired today, and I just needed rest.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. Today I needed rest. Today I needed not to get to the list.
And that's part of really nurturing yourself. I mean, that would be the kind of thing you would hope you would get growing up, that, you know, you've had a really hard day. Go ahead and take a nap. Your homework could wait till tomorrow, you know, or something.
Right. And in the first chapter, I talked about, you know, the inner nurturer is an inner limit setter. And so she's going to help you set limits. Like, she's not going to be an inner indulger where she always says, okay, put the list off till tomorrow. Oh, you didn't get to it today. Okay, put it off till tomorrow. She needs to be a nurturer that says, it's okay, you were very tired today, you didn't get to the list, and we do need to return that call tomorrow, right? So we also want to develop that limit-setting voice.
And that's really hard with the boundary setting, especially if you never had that modeled for you growing up from your parents, and then learning to, what are those boundaries? Where is the loving guidance here?
It is, and just to digress for a second, there's a chapter in the book where I work on both developing that inner limit-setting voice with yourself, and that is the same voice as the inner nurturer. So she's kind, she's warm, she says, it's okay if you want to go to Mrs. Fields and get a cookie, but only one. No, you cannot buy a bag to take home.
Just what I did yesterday.
You what?
Just what I did yesterday.
Right. So she is a nurturer. She says it's totally okay for you to have a cookie. And she's also a limit setter. We will not be getting any more than one. We are not taking a bag home. We're only getting one.
I guess
we have to develop that limit setting voice. And also we have to be able to set those boundaries with other people. So in the book, I'm teaching that as well.
Sometimes it's easier to set it with other people than it is ourselves.
It is, but it's just a muscle. In my groups, sometimes I'll come in and I'll say, okay, this week I want to hear where you set limits with yourself, and I want to hear what that voice is sounding like. And people will say, I didn't do good with limits this week. You know, my inner indulger was out and about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I say, okay, this week I want you to practice. I want it to be in your consciousness. Where, and try small, you know, somewhere where you feel you can do it. Where can you set a limit? So you went into the bagel store and you wanted to get a bagel, and you heard that voice say, well, take a dozen home with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the family will want them. And you know the truth is nobody else has been asking for bagels.
Mm-hmm.
So try to access that inner limit-setting voice that says, no, just because they're cheaper, if you buy a dozen, you know, just because the gallon of ice cream is cheaper than the pint, let's just get one.
Okay.
Right?
So that
learning to develop that voice.
So that would be the habit one, learning those self-affirming commentary, dialogue, setting those loving boundaries.
Right. Habit number two is adjusting your expectations. So this is a very important place where emotional eaters can get into trouble, where their expectations of themselves can be too high. So a lot of people I work with are overachievers, and they're perfectionistic, and their expectations are too high of themselves and others. Or often their expectations are too low. They're not pushing themselves enough, you know, to really meet some of their expectations. So we have to look and see, where are the expectations?
Mm-hmm.
Habit number three, which is probably more critical for women than men, is use comparisons for inspiration and motivation only. Okay?
Can you explain that?
As women, most of us compare ourselves to others endlessly. And someone is always winning and someone's always losing. And I ask, again, women particularly, to begin to stop making comparisons in that way. So if you see a woman and she has a beautiful figure and you love her look, rather than have a "she looks like this but I don't" kind of conversation in your head, take yourself out of the equation and just admire her. Just say, "She inspires me. She looks incredible. I love her style. I would love to get my body looking like hers." Mm-hmm. Just use comparisons for inspiration.
Stop making
yourself look bad next to someone, and stop making yourself better than someone.
That's the key, because if you can make yourself bad, you can make yourself better. And we're all just people in our own
bodies. And we're all just doing the best we can, right? So
right.
You don't want to have to go hang out with people that, in your mind, look worse than you for you to feel better, right? Or avoid activities where people are going to look better than you mm-hmm. because you feel bad. You know, learning how to stop that whole comparison-making process. And the fourth habit that people with a healthy level of self-esteem have is that they forgive themselves for perceived mistakes and failures. This is so critical. I cannot tell you how often I work with people. I was working with someone recently who said, "I cannot forgive myself for X, Y, and Z that I did 20 years ago that I feel ruined my life." Right? So to hold on to that energy of self-criticism, you know, and lack of forgiveness for 20 years, of course it's going to fuel emotional eating.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to get some comfort because inside of you is such harshness. So I give techniques in the book on all of these habits. I give you techniques for learning how do you begin the process of forgiving yourself. It's a process. It doesn't happen overnight.
And that's what I really like about your book. It's very step-by-step and very thorough. It's the most amazing book I've ever read on the subject or anywhere near it.
Well, the reason I made it so thorough is because of my own journey. You know, as I journeyed through resolving my overeating, I began to understand that my overeating was driven predominantly by emotions, but it wasn't just driven by emotions. It was driven also by body imbalance. It was also driven by spiritual imbalance. And I couldn't find things to help me. I couldn't find any book that put all that together. So I thought, okay, I've got to write a book that will put all that together.
Well, you definitely wrote a book that brought it all together. That is for sure. Now, just to jump ahead, because we only have about 10 minutes or so left, I do want to talk about how genetics and lifestyle causes that body and brain conditions to be irregular. And you talk in the book, I think it's chapter 9, about neurotransmitter deficiency symptoms. You know, we talk a lot about serotonin and dopamine and epinephrine. And how does that play a part? Because we've got the environmental situation of growing up and maybe not getting the nurturing, but how does our brain chemistry and our body and genetics play a role in this?
Well, our brain chemistry in particular shows up quite a bit for overeaters. And if we think about overeating in terms of three categories, non-compulsive, you know, people who don't compulsively eat, and then people who compulsively eat, which would include binge eating disorder and bulimia. In the compulsive and the compulsive categories, binge eating disorder and bulimia, you're typically seeing people who have brain chemistry imbalances that lead them to use food because their brain chemicals are low.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can work with someone and I can treat their emotional imbalances, but if they keep going to food because their brain chemicals are low, their brain chemicals have to be addressed. And they may also be going to food because they have food allergies. It's another condition that can trigger food addiction. They might have hormonal imbalances. I can't tell you how many women I've worked with over the years who have PMS and tell me, I binge for 3 weeks straight every month.
Mm-hmm.
That is not all emotional. a certain amount of that is that their sex hormones are imbalanced. So we can address the biochemical imbalances, and those things are not that hard to adjust. And a significant portion of overeating can be reduced just by addressing the biochemical imbalances that are either genetic or lifestyle derived.
Is that where you would send somebody to maybe see an allergist or to their doctor? To
an alternative health care provider.
Okay.
So if their hormones are imbalanced, send them to a psychopharmacologist if their brain chemistry is imbalanced. There's a lot of self-help that I can direct people to in terms of just adjusting their brain chemicals with, natural over-the-counter supplements.
Mm-hmm.
Food allergies, even in the book, I give techniques for addressing your food allergies, because food allergy testing isn't all that effective, but you can get some testing. But there are protocols you can follow to address food allergies. So all of this is, fairly easily addressed. Fairly easily addressed. I give a lot of, and also if people want some resources on my website, which is overeatingrecovery.com, I have a whole page of resources of where you can, find alternative healthcare practitioners and psychopharmacologists.
Mm-hmm. And that's great, because we could always use more resources. I know also in the book you talk about how chronic stress could lead to emotional eating. What would you consider chronic stress?
Chronic stress, I think, would be, for example, someone who's going through a divorce, someone who has a stressful job, someone who's in a relationship that's difficult. Chronic stress can be being single. And, being really frustrated by being single. Chronic stress can be not having enough friends. Chronic stress can be a health condition that is very challenging to deal with. We're living in a very challenging time, in 21st century. Most of us have a considerable amount of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, in the book I give techniques for reducing this, because stress dramatically alters our hormones. It increases cortisol levels, and when cortisol levels are higher, we're much more apt to eat. When we have a lot of stress, we're often not sleeping well. A lot of us are cutting corners on sleep. When we're sleep deprived, our appetite stimulating and breaking hormones get imbalanced. We're much more likely to overeat when we're not sleeping well.
Mm-hmm.
We need rejuvenative quality sleep. We need downtime that's not stressful.
Mm-hmm.
These are all really important areas to address. And I know it can sound overwhelming, for listeners. Like, oh, my God, where do I start? Like, everything she's talking about, I have a problem with. And I say in the book, you can dive in anywhere, any place. If you think you want to address some of the physical stuff, start there.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to address some of the emotional stuff first, start there. If the spiritual stuff is calling to you, start there. Anywhere you start, you'll start to make a dent in your emotional eating.
Yeah. And before we go any further about talking about your books, I do have a couple listener questions for you.
Okay.
Make sure I get these in. The first one is, my granddaughter is 14 years old, 5'8" tall, and 160 pounds and gaining. A strikingly beautiful girl, but her eating is out of control. She eats her normal selections of foods, but she is munching on chips, cookies, and the like in between meals. Her mother has made a few half-hearted attempts to stop this, but will not take me seriously when I say that she needs to see a psychologist about this condition. I believe it is stress-related, school, friends, etc. Would your book help both of them?
Oh, totally. How old is the girl again?
14.
14, yes. I think the book would help her mother the most. It depends how mature she is in terms of her reading the book. But I think together, them reading the emotional material,
mm-hmm.
Would help a lot, especially skill number one, learning how to identify those emotions and needs.
Mm-hmm.
Having mom learn how to talk to her in a nourishing voice, teaching her daughter how to self-soothe and comfort herself rather than turn to food.
Yeah, I could see where it would be very helpful for mothers to be reading this book, not only for themselves but for their children, to teach them good soothing habits and self-soothing.
Yeah, and the other thing I would just say really quickly would be to, it is best to not keep a lot of this kind of junk food. We call this modern palatable foods. You know, they're foods that lift our brain chemicals, hijack our brain chemicals really quickly. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like her daughter is sensitive to that. She happens to be sensitive to these kind of modern processed junk foods.
Oh.
So I would want the mother to not keep as much of this in the house.
It would help minimize it, but, I mean, I go to the schools and I see kids with hot Cheetos in their hands all day long. And so it's kind of hard to get them away from the junk food there, but I guess in the home you do have control of what comes in the home and what's in the home. And
have more control. I mean, I just the other day I saw some kids walking across the street and they had like a big gulp and Cheetos, and I'm like, oh, my God, what are we doing? Putting all these preservatives and chemicals and processed things. Like you said, you don't have much control when your kid is out and about, but you certainly can encourage your child to grab an apple, to grab a banana, and get, you know, work on building those habits.
Right.
Back then.
Or even just going for a bike ride instead of grabbing.
Going for a bike ride, right. But for sure, like if her daughter's upset, for sure, beginning to identify what are you feeling, what do you need in this situation, talk to her in a soothing, nourishing voice so she can learn how to do that process with herself. She's going to need that skill.
Yeah, make a space for it. Make it okay. A lot of people don't want to hear that their child's upset, or they don't want to acknowledge the feelings, or they minimize it.
Right, and when you're in adolescence, my God, I mean, that's a time where everything's in flux. And kids just need a tremendous amount of reassurance and validation.
Sure.
These days.
You know, I want to keep going here. We only have a couple more minutes, but I want to talk really briefly about what I think is one of the more important areas. I mean, it's all important, but in your book, you talk about spiritual hunger. Can you describe that, and what are some of the signs of spiritual depletion that emotional eaters can watch out for?
Well, spiritual hunger represents a longing or a yearning for peace, inspiration, passion, purpose, meaning, you know, for your life to feel expansive and good. Mm-hmm. And some of the symptoms, the signs of spiritual depletion that emotional eaters can watch out for is if on a regular basis you're feeling any of the following: emptiness, restlessness, unease, purposelessness, meaninglessness, lack of inspiration and motivation, boredom, mm-hmm. loneliness, longing for there to be more in life, lack of personal fulfillment, a general sense of disconnect or dissatisfaction, or a sense of feeling lost in your life. So I would say there's a spiritual component to your eating.
Mm-hmm. I think we're all spiritual, emotional, and psychological beings, and we're all connected. So we have to address all these areas and make sure they're all healthy and in balance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, if there's emotional eaters or professionals who work with emotional eaters, want to learn more about these skills and principles and practices, we have your book here, The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual. But where else can they learn more information?
Well, they can go to my website at overeatingrecovery.com, and I have, for people in L.A., I have a live 12-week emotional eating recovery program coming up in March.
Great.
And later in March, I will have the same program will be up in a teleseminar format for people that aren't in L.A. or, you know, just can't get to my office, you know, at a reasonable time.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be a teleseminar format of that. I do, you know, individual, group work, phone, Skype, so, you know, they can get to me. And also, the book has so much material for them.
Yes.
And my website has a lot of blog articles that are informative, that will help you work on some of the skills. So there's lots of stuff for people, and there's a lot of resources on the website as well.
Right, and if you're not near or close enough to see Julie, or she probably doesn't have time to see everybody that could possibly want to see you, but you could also utilize the book and take it to your own therapist and work together on some of these skills and get that extra support and nurturing.
that would be totally perfect thing to do, is take this book and work, if you have a therapist, take this book and work with your therapist on some of these skills.
Yeah, because it's a fabulous book.
Perfect thing.
I think it's my number one favorite book right now. So I highly recommend it to all my clients and everybody else that works with that. We do have to wrap it up. I would wish we had another hour or so to spend, Julie. There's just so much information.
We'll need to do another show on it.
Well, that would be great. We could do part two and get deeper into details here. But I do thank you, Julie Simon, the author of Emotional Eater's Repair Manual, licensed psychotherapist and life coach located in Los Angeles, California. Again, her website is overeatingrecovery.com. If you want more information, or you could check our website at www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. We'll have our information up on that as well. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Well, have a great day, and everybody take care and be well. Until next time, for more Answers of the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and guest host Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.